on House Business and Labor for April 12, 2013. We're going to be kind of jumping around today, and but the first thing we're going to hear is, Representative Denbrough, which bill is it?
I don't know.
We are going to open a here a
I don't know.
Public hearing on House Bill 3307. Representative Denbrough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for letting me go first. I got to get next door where they were waiting for me.
Yeah.
I'm Michael Denbrough. I represent House District 45. That's Northeast Portland out to Park Rose, and it's a pleasure to be back here before the Business and Labor Committee. Colleagues, as you probably know, Jan, did you want to read the bill, or should I?
Madam Chair, committee members, this bill requires the employer who fails to provide a meal period or a rest break in accordance with the rules adopted by BOLI to pay additional 1.5 hours of wages for each day that the employer violated the rules. And there is a proposed Dash 1 amendment before you.
Thank you, Jan. Colleagues, as you probably know, BOLI regulations require that employees receive 2 10-minute paid breaks during an 8-hour shift. They also require a paid lunch break of 30 minutes. I don't need to tell you why these breaks are important. All workers need breaks if they're going to remain fully functional at their jobs. Workers who do physical repetitive labor certainly need breaks, but really all workers need breaks. Some workers have medical conditions, such as diabetes, that absolutely require them to take a break and take some nourishment, or else they will experience serious medical consequences. For most of us, this is a no-brainer, and it's inconceivable that employers would not give workers the breaks that they need or would actually prohibit them from taking breaks. And I'm happy to report that most employers are very good actors in this regard. But unfortunately, there are bad actors out there, employers who either actively impede their workers from taking the breaks that they deserve and need, or who send out subtle messages that lead workers to believe that they ought not to take their breaks. This is wrong, this is abusive behavior, and it is illegal, according to the Oregon Supreme Court. But under current statute, employers are not subject to penalty as a result of this behavior, so there are not adequate disincentives for them to be bad actors. House Bill 3307 imposes a penalty of 1.5 hours of pay for each day that required breaks are not taken or paid. That's the disincentive to employers. In some cases, the violation will be easy to detect. A line worker cannot leave the line unless he or she is relieved. If that doesn't occur, there is an obvious violation and a remedy is in order. However, we can imagine situations in which the employee doesn't have to wait to be relieved and has more or less control over his or her schedule. What happens if he or she chooses not to take a break, then decides after the fact to sue the company for damages? The Dash 1 amendments to the bill fix that potential problem by clarifying that the burden of proof is on the employee to show that the employer knew that he or she was not taking breaks, a situation that the employer either provoked or ignored. If the employee cannot demonstrate that the employer was aware of this violation, then the complaint cannot be supported. But if the employee can show that the employer was aware of the violation and did not take steps to rectify the situation so that the employee is taking the required breaks, then the employer is liable for the penalties assessed. Colleagues, the people who come after me will be able to tell their stories of abuse under the current state of affairs, or will be able to explain the legal ramifications of the bill. I'll leave that up to them. With that, colleagues, I urge you to support this bill, House Bill 3307. My understanding is that BOLI is supportive of this bill. It's a good bill, good for the heart and soul, good for the productivity and sense of self-determination and pride at work that Oregonians need. I'd be happy to answer any quick questions, and then I'll take my leave. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Denbrough. Are there any questions of Representative Denbrough?
Thank you very much.
Can I continue on this one?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. continue with this one. How about the next panel, Elizabeth Kushwa, Michael Dale. As I say, we've got lots to do today, so if you can keep our testimony succinct. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Michael Dale from the Northwest Worker Justice Project. We support this bill. It's a matter of basic dignity of the job. It's fairly straightforward. The only thing I would add to my written testimony is simply that this is a matter of dignity, but it's also a matter of health and safety. People that work in long hours or in strenuous work, if they don't get breaks, they get hurt. They get hurt on the job, and so we need to have a means of enforcing it. The only means of enforcing it at present is a BOLI fine. BOLI can't be in all places at all times and can't investigate every place, and this provides another remedy. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to respond.
Very much.
Good morning, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. For the record, Elizabeth Kushwa with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I'm speaking to the bill, not the amendments today. Currently, excuse me, to clarify something that Representative Dembro mentioned, currently there is a fine, a civil penalty that can be assessed in cases where there are meal or rest period violations. Currently, the way we handle this is that when we investigate these, we usually just educate the employers. And usually we have voluntary compliance. In very, very rare cases with these complaints do we have the possibility to assess a civil penalty at that point. So that you know, once BOLI's expenses for that investigation are taken care of, the remainder of that penalty goes to the common school fund. So I just wanted to clarify how that money is being spent when, in the rare instance, it's collected.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions of the panelists? Representative Thompson.
Elizabeth, if there's already a fine in place, what's the difference between fining someone and doing a wage offset? Because in either case, you have to know the violation occurred.
Chair, Representative Thompson, you're correct in that, yes, once the violation has been reported, the difference between current law and this proposed bill is that under current law, the payment of these lost periods do not go to the worker. So the worker, him or herself, is never compensated for those lost periods, and that's what this bill does.
Okay.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Elizabeth. What kind of evidence would an employee need to show to BOLI to make their case?
Chair, Representative Thatcher, I can't answer specifically what evidence that an employee would have. I can find that information out for you. That's why we feel strongly about the bill in its current form. The presumption under current law in all of these cases is that the burden is on the employer to know what the laws are, and there's plenty of training and posters and everything else that indicate that. So we're not for flipping a presumption.
Okay, thank you. Other questions? Okay, seeing none. Thank you very much. Okay, next we have Ian Tolson and Roger Beyer.
Good morning, Chair Doherty, member of the committee. Ian Tolleson with Oregon Farm Bureau. We oppose House Bill 3307. Farm Bureau is definitely in support of giving employees breaks, rests, lunches. It's strenuous work. We realize that, you know, employees need to catch their breath and whatnot. Where the problem comes in is a lot of our employees are piece-rate. So there is a large incentive for the employee to work as much as they can and to pick as much as they can, because that would result in a larger paycheck. We feel this would actually penalize the employee and able to do that. Current law, as you just heard, does have the appropriate penalties, and I was under the assumption that BOLI would then turn over some of those penalties to the employee. which would make sense to us. If there are bad actors, we feel they should be punished, and the penalties that are currently there are adequate. And then Bowley should take some of that and then maybe give it to the employer, whatever. But just to add restrictions to employer. And time and a half, you know, you're talking two 15-minute breaks and a half-hour lunch period. If they blow through their whole day and don't provide anything, that's not even an hour's worth of work. It's kind of small. Maybe the penalty route would actually result in, a larger hit to the employee. So we feel this just doesn't really work for ag, and so therefore we oppose the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer. I'm here representing the Oregon Blueberry Commission. I guess my comments would be very similar to those that you just heard from Ms. Tolson. In the blueberry world, the pickers are picking. It is to their advantage. The more they can pick in a given day, the more money they make. They're working on a piece rate. It's usually being paid by the pound. Our employees, it's very difficult them to get them to get out of the field, take their breaks. I mean, the employers, by rule today, all are mandated to have policies and require breaks and meal times, and they strive to do that, but it's very difficult because it's actually penalizing the workers when they're requiring them to take a break during the day, because the more time they have off, the less money they make. So again, just like you heard from Mr. Tolson, it doesn't work in ag. Our employers do everything they can to try to follow the law and make it work, but in fact, it's penalizing the workers. So with that, happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you very much. Do you have any questions of the panelists? Actually, I have one for Ian. And with the Farm Bureau, if you're doing piecework for lack of a better term, when you're getting paid by the flat, mm-hmm. How do you figure out an hourly rate?
Madam Chair, I don't know exactly that. Maybe Roger can maybe speak a little bit better to that, but I believe that they it's some calculation that they do at the end of the day by the crop, if I'm correct.
Yeah. Madam Chair, in the blueberry world, each and every picker, for the most part, in most of the operations now, they are all computerized. They're given a specific card, a number. They are scanned in at the beginning of the day. As they bring their buckets in during the day, their buckets are weighed. They are tagged with that person's identification scan, and at the end of the day, it's calculated, and they're required by law to pay whichever is more, the piece rate or the hourly rate. So that's how they do it. That some of the smaller operations maybe don't have the computer systems. In those cases, they would just log the people in at the beginning of the day. They'd weigh their produce at the end of the day, whatever it is, in this case blueberries. At the end of the day, when they log them out, they would again calculate whichever is higher, the piece rate or the hourly rate, and they pay them the higher of that, higher of minimum wage or the piece rate. Okay. They are required by state law and federal law to make at least minimum wage for the entire time, minus the two break and meal times that they are in the field.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much. We have a few more. Why don't we, do you want to end with these guys? Or? Okay, how about Jose Luis Hernandez Maldonado, Maria Rosa Rivera, and Javier Lara? And then the last two we have are Hank Kaplan and Rex Higgins. Thank you. Yes. They're hooked. I think the chairs are hooked together.
Here we go.
Brandon's got one. Thank you.
Got one here.
Welcome. Good morning. Okay. And again, if we could keep the testimony brief. Thank you.
Estimados miembros del comité.
Esteemed members of the committee.
Buenos días.
Good morning.
Mi nombre es José Luis Hernández Maldonado.
My name is José Luis Hernández Maldonado.
Y vivo en Eugene, Oregon.
And I live in Eugene, Oregon.
Mi trabajo es construcción.
My work is construction.
Estoy aquí para apoyar la respuesta HB 3307.
I'm here to support the proposal HB 3307.
Porque he trabajado para varias compañías que nos dan los que no dan los descansos requeridos por la ley.
Because I've worked for a number of companies that don't actually give the breaks that are required by law.
Ellos no quieren que pare uno, quieren producción.
They don't want that their employees stop, they want production.
Y no les importa lo que sus empleados piensan.
It doesn't really matter to them what their employees think.
El año pasado trabajé haciendo drywall y demolición en una compañía de remodelación.
So last year I worked doing drywall and demolition in a company that was doing a remodel.
Durante tres semanas de trabajo, esta compañía no nos dio descansos.
So during 3 weeks of work, this company didn't give us breaks.
Trabajamos de 8 a 10 horas al día y solamente recibimos 15 minutos de descanso.
So we worked for 8 or 10 hours a day and we only received about 15 minutes of the lunch break.
A la hora de almorzar había un supervisor constantemente mirándonos.
So there was a supervisor constantly watching us.
Pedimos a nuestro supervisor que nos diera descansos.
We asked our supervisor to give us breaks.
Pero nos dijo que no tuviéramos que seguir. Pero nos dijo que tuviéramos que seguir trabajando y que pudiéramos descansar durante el lonche.
But he told us that no, that we had to keep working and that we could rest during that lunch.
Nos dijo que si no nos gustó, nos fuéramos.
He told us that if we didn't like it, we could leave.
Al escuchar esto, nos quedamos silencios y seguimos trabajando.
So upon hearing that, we stayed silent and kept working.
Fue muy frustrante porque pensábamos que teníamos derecho a ir al baño o ir a tomar agua.
It was frustrating because we felt that we had the right to go to the bathroom or drink some water.
Es difícil trabajar en construcción sin descansos porque es muy fatigoso.
It's hard to work in construction without breaks because it's exhausting.
Y andas muy cansado y no puedes pensar igual.
You get really tired and you can't think the same.
Okay. Is there any way we can summarize his testimony, please, near the end?
He's only got a paragraph left.
Okay. Espero que ustedes apoyen esta ley porque mi historia no es la única. Hay muchos trabajadores que no reciben descansos y no es justo. Los necesitamos y los merecemos.
Mm-hmm. So I hope that you will support this law because, honestly, my story is not unique. There are many workers that don't receive their breaks and it's not right. We need them and we deserve them.
La ley nos debe apoyar en decirles a nuestros patrones que respeten nuestros derechos.
So the law ought to support us in telling our workers or telling our employers that they should respect our rights.
Gracias. Thank you very much. Okay, same thing. If we could summarize testimonies. Thank you.
Buenos días, estimados miembros del comité.
Good morning, esteemed members of the committee.
Mi nombre es María Rosa Rivera, vivo en Salem, Oregon.
My name is María Rosa Rivera, and I live in Salem.
Gracias por la oportunidad de estar aquí hablando aquí enfrente con ustedes.
So thank you for the opportunity to be here speaking in front of you all with you.
Okay, vengo a comentar un poco de lo que me pasó en el último trabajo.
I'm here to tell you a little bit about what happened in my last job.
Trabajaba entre unas 12 horas a 13 horas.
I was working 12 or 13 hours a day.
En las mañanas sí agarraba, me daban mi break de 15 minutos, mi lonche.
So in the morning I did get my 15 minute break and then my lunch break.
Pero ya después de las 12 y media a 5 y media o 6 de la tarde ya no tomaba el otro break.
But then after about 12:30 until 5:30 or 6 in the afternoon, I didn't get another break.
Hacía un trabajo que era muy muy rápido, lo tenía que llevar los productos, los empacaban, los llevaba de la línea al freezer.
So I did a job that was really fast. I had to carry the products from the assembly line over to the freezers.
En ocasiones le llegué a pedir a un break para ir al baño o descansar y mal por más o menos fue por unos un año que estuve pasando por esto. Me decían solamente, oh, no hay quien te reemplace.
So I would sometimes I would go and ask for breaks to go to the bathroom or eat something. It was about a year that I was experiencing this, and I would be told that there really wasn't anybody to replace me.
En ocasiones yo me llegué a ir al baño sin decirles. Cuando regresaba me decían que por qué me había ido sin el permiso de ellos y solo me decían, pues te voy a correr.
Sometimes I just had to go to the bathroom, so I'd go without permission, and when I got back, they would scold me, ask me why I'd left, and threaten that they were going to fire me.
En esos momentos pensaba que sí estaba violando las leyes del trabajo por irme sin un permiso, pero era necesario para yo ir al baño o si salir al baño. Era muy estresante el trabajo, muy pesado.
So I was worried that maybe I was doing something, breaking the rules by going to the bathroom, but it was necessary to take a break, go to the bathroom, because it was very stressful work.
Durante ese tiempo, varias veces llegué a mi casa, llevaba cansada, estresada.
So, you know, during this time, I'd end up getting home really tired, really stressed.
A veces le contestaba mal a mis hijos.
Sometimes I even, you know, kind of was harsh with my children.
Pues es algo que todavía no he podido solucionar.
You know, I still haven't been able to resolve some of that stress and anxiety.
Todavía cuando tengo que ir a un trabajo, lo pienso antes de entrar al lugar.
So still when I have to go to work, I think about this before entering my job.
Y yo pienso que como seres humanos por derecho tenemos derecho al break que nos pertenece, que por ley nos pertenece tomar dos breaks, un lonche si trabajamos 8 horas.
I think that as human beings we have this right to our breaks. The law even gives us this right to take 2 breaks and a lunch break if we work for 8 hours.
Creo que fue injusto porque eran a veces de 12 a 13 horas los que yo trabajaba.
I think it was wrong. It was unjust because these were 12 or 13 hours that I was working at a time.
Y no estoy solamente hablando solo por mí, sino por muchas más personas que sufren este caso. Donde yo trabajé, lo miraba.
I'm not just speaking for myself. I'm speaking for many other workers that really suffer the same thing. When I was at work, I saw that.
Les digo, pues, estoy aquí y me gustaría que hicieran algo por no sé qué podrían hacer para que los patrones respeten esas leyes. Como seres humanos tenemos derecho a que nos respeten.
So I'm here because I would like you to do something, you know, whatever you can do so that employers respect these rights and these laws. You know, as human beings, I think we have these rights.
Y estoy aquí apoyando al HB 3307.
So I am here supporting HB 3307.
Pues creo que es todo. Gracias.
So I think that's it.
Me
Thank
disculpan.
You. Excuse me. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Good morning, Representative Margaret Dorothy, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Javier Lara. On behalf of PECUN, Oregon Farm Workers Union, we strongly support the passage of HB 3307. During 2 decades, PECUN has been working, you know, to advocate for the rights of farm workers. And recently, PECUN opened its membership to the community at large. Conducting neck takes regarding, you know, labor abuses in various sectors now, unfortunately, the lack of breaks and lunch time is a labor violation that I encounter constantly. I'm still impacted specifically for this a case that I took recently in which 4 workers were under supervision, were pushed to work up to 10 to 12 hours a day without lunch and breaks, of course. And it was so badly that one of the workers, got sick and requested medical assistance because of the stomach pain that he was suffering because of not eating. So PECUN, you know, strongly
believes that no worker should, you know, place their health at risk. And clearly this affects the worker's health and the company's production as well. So therefore, you know, we believe that HB 3307 is a necessary proposition. We strongly believe that workers need an effective way to enforce their rights to rest breaks so the employers are more likely to comply with the law. In addition, the listing that workers can get affected, you know, it will be, and if, you know, the listing that workers can get after their damages, as in the case mentioned above, is financial compensation. So with this, we appreciate the opportunity to share the, you know, we thank you for the opportunity to share in our views, and we urge you to adjust vote on HB 3307.
Okay,
thank you.
Thank you very much. Before we go on, the interpreter needs to also say what her name is for the record.
Sure. My name is Lindsay Johnson.
Thank you very much, Ms. Johnson. Questions? Representative Kinnemer.
Yeah, I guess I'm having trouble understanding what this bill, how this bill will actually result in the enforcement of your rights. Seems to me that the problem is that you have rights that are not being enforced currently. And I'm not sure a new law does anything because it provides that you make a complaint to Bully and then they have to investigate. So I'm not seeing how this moves you ahead. I don't think more laws always makes things better. Somehow we need to enforce the laws we have because you're supposed to have breaks. I totally get that.
Right.
I support that. I think that's the right, humane, and decent thing to do. And frankly, honest, good, responsible owners do that. And more laws don't make irresponsible and mean-spirited people do the right thing unless there's enforcement.
Thank you, Representative Kinnemer. You know, to answer your question or your thoughts, we understand there are present laws, but as you hear in the panels previous me, there's laws that are not really enforcing or forcing the employers to compensate, especially workers who have worked really hard and they deserve these breaks. So in a way, right now, this is an opportunity to make these employers to pay consequences for this bad behavior. And of course, a gratitude to our workers that they deserve. It's not free. They work for it. And under this law, they will be getting this compensation.
And also, Mr. McKinnon, maybe the next panel can also answer,
yeah,
address
yeah.
Your yeah. issue also.
Thank you. I just
okay, any other questions of the panel? Representative Thatcher.
Yeah, actually, it was just occurring to me while folks were speaking, I think Maria telling her story, especially it hit me that, and maybe this is a question for Bully, but it seems like retaliating or punishing or otherwise firing somebody or threatening to fire somebody because they want to have their breaks, I mean, that just stands out to me as a blatant abuse,
yeah.
And that maybe that would be the tact to take,
yeah.
You know?
With Bully, not
yeah,
Bully.
But I don't know if that's currently, you know, illegal or
Elizabeth,
not.
Would you like to address that? Because it seems that Civil Rights Division and others, so.
Representative Thatcher, Representative Doherty, for the record, Elizabeth Cushwa with Bully. Yes, that's currently covered under 659A in the whistleblowing statutes. You can't, if you complain about a violation like that.
Okay. Well, I guess maybe letting folks know that that is the case would help. And also, what is the punishment for somebody violating that, you know, an employer violating that, not letting them have breaks?
Again, Representative Chair Doherty, Representative Thatcher, usually when we get these complaints, we do a little education first, and then it is a civil penalty of up to $1,000. That's the actual maximum. It can be anywhere between zero and $1,000.
Per employee?
Per occasion.
Per occasion.
Okay. Thank you very much. Is that your question? Okay, other questions? Okay, thank you very much
thank
for your
you.
Testimony. It was very good. Thank you.
Yes.
Okay, and the last two, we have Rex Higgins and Hank Kaplan. Thank you, Mr. Kaplan. It's just been a year or two since I've seen you.
Good morning, Representative Daugherty, members of the commission, of the committee. My name is Hank Kaplan. I'm coming here wearing two hats. One is as the managing partner of Bennett Hartman Morrison Kaplan, a law firm that has been heavily engaged in labor and employment litigation, and I've personally been involved in labor and employment litigation for about 25 years. And the other hat that I wear is as a representative of the Community Relations Committee of the Jewish Federation of Portland, which strongly supports this and all of the wage theft legislation. There's a couple of the points that I've heard this morning I'd like to briefly address. First, it's always heartwarming to hear the employers' representatives express concern about the welfare of the workers who are going to be somehow thwarted from making the maximum amount of wages as a result of having to take their breaks. But I think it's telling that you won't hear any employees testifying that they feel that this legislation is going to be interfering with their ability to make a livelihood. As far as the there's been some concerns expressed about the enforcement provisions of this legislation. First of all, one of the things that this legislation does is it creates a private right of action. So it's not just BOLI that is involved in the enforcement. BOLI can't be everywhere, and in many parts of the states, BOLI has almost no presence. BOLI doesn't have the budget or the ability to enforce this legislation, which I guess brings me to another point that I hear often, not only with respect to this legislation, but with respect to these types of bills creating a private right of action for workers, and that is the suggestion that the only purpose of this bill is to make money for the lawyers. Whenever you hear the argument that the purpose of the bill is to make money for the lawyers, that's code. I hope you understand. That's code for nobody enforces this law because there's really no teeth in it, and we'd like to keep it that way. So creating a private right of action has the effect of enforcing the law, not necessarily because the lawyers will get a lot more business out of it, but because it's self-executing, because employers understand that if there's the real threat that the law is going to be enforced against them, then they will comply with what the law is. Wage theft is not widespread because it's legal. Wage theft is widespread because people get away with it. Once you put real teeth in existing legislation, it becomes to a large extent self-executing. So lawyers like me will probably not end up with very many of these cases, but if there's a real remedy. But if there's no real remedy, if the only enforcement is a fine from BOLI, part of which goes to the school fund, nothing will change. There is a problem here, and this legislation is designed to directly address this problem. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Higgins.
Chair Daugherty, Vice Chair Martin, Vice Chair Kenner, members of the committee. My name is Rex Higgins, and I'm the Vice Chair of Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, EMO's Public Policy Committee. I'm here today to urge you to support HB 3307. As a statewide association of religious denominations, congregations, and community-based cooperative ministries, EMO represents hundreds of Oregonians in every rural and urban community throughout the state. Our testimony today emanates from our shared religious values, which affirm the dignity and worth of every human being and a concern for every person's well-being. This is why we ask you to support 3307. Despite the existence of basic wage and hour laws and regulations in our state, some employers unfortunately do continue to disregard them in ways both large and small. Unfortunately, these violations are most often committed against low-wage workers. Low-wage workers who don't get paid are left without sufficient money to provide food and shelter for their families. Such actions not only violate the law, they also transgress basic moral principles. Jewish and Christian scriptures are unequivocal. Thou shalt not steal. From Deuteronomy 24:15, we read, you must pay out the wages due on the same day before the sun sets, for the worker is needy and urgently depends on it. Breaks are vitally important to workers, especially to those performing physical repetitive labor. The disabled also require breaks. Consider the person with diabetes who must eat regularly, check his blood sugar, and take insulin. Failure to provide breaks is a safety issue. HB 3305 does indeed provide a remedy for workers who fail, whose employers fail to provide and pay for the required breaks. It also, as I think you've just heard, provides an incentive to employers who fail to do that. When this failure occurs, work becomes a form of exploitation. In the face of exploitation and injustice, Oregon's faith communities will not stay silent, and neither should our elected officials. I urge you to support HB 3307. It will help ensure ethical treatment for our workers and contribute to a more just and prosperous future for all Oregonians. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions of the panel? Representative Fagan.
Thank you. I think this is probably the first speaker, although I neglected to write down your name. I'm
Hank
sorry.
Kaplan.
Hank, thank you. You mentioned the private right of action, and that, I think, was partly why I was confused when I was reading the bill. It doesn't look to me like this language actually authorizes a private right of action outside of a BOLI complaint. So there would be a BOLI complaint. I mean, this is what it looks like to me. There'd be a BOLI complaint if BOLI finds a violation, just like BOLI always has done it. This, the only change would be that in addition to the fines, they would have to pay the employee. But if BOLI was not to find a violation, they're not, at least as I read it, they're not able to then go file in circuit court. Is that...
Well, it does create a private right of action because it creates a wage remedy, and then the employee can file a wage claim under the regular wage claim statutes.
Okay.
A wage remedy as opposed to a fine means that you've got a wage action.
Okay. Other questions? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You may not be the best two people to answer the question, but I'll pose it and perhaps someone else can answer it. Can you give us an idea of what industries this type of wage theft or lack of adequate number of breaks is a problem?
I have no way to know exactly. I have an opinion, but that's all it is.
I have an opinion as well that it's widespread in many industries. It's particularly a problem in industries where you have a lot of manual and physical labor, because certainly our office sees a lot of workers' compensation claims arising from people who are simply overworked. I would defer to Mr. Dale to list industries in terms of the numbers of where the highest numbers are, but I think it's fairly widespread. Even in clerical industries, there are employers who discourage their employees from taking these breaks.
Okay, if you could be brief, we need to move on with this because we're going to run out of time for everything else. So,
Michael Dale, I with Northwest Worker Justice Project, I would simply say that it tends to be most of a problem where wages are low and where the need for output within a certain time frame is really concentrated. So that means in food processing, it means in Christmas trees, it means in agriculture. We see it in other places as well, but it's basically where we've got a lot of work to do in a short period of time. It can't be done tomorrow. Those kinds of industries.
Okay, other questions? Representative Kenmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess maybe Mr. Captain. I'm not sure that layering on another level of private right of action or anything in that area, just it sounded to me like, if I understood what you said, we ought to increase the fine for this kind of misconduct. That would be where the value would be. So if we put the fine at $500 or something, what do you think?
Representative Daugherty, Chair Daugherty, Representative Kinnemer, the problem isn't necessarily one of adequate penalty once somebody's caught. The problem is getting caught. The problem is that there aren't, that BOLI can't be everywhere, and there aren't enough BOLI investigators to adequately enforce this law. Sure, once BOLI gets involved with an employer who's been violating it, then I suppose a greater fine might be more of a disincentive, but creating a private right of action where anyone can go to an attorney and have the attorney file the claim without waiting for Boley to act will create more widespread enforcement and, frankly, will deter employers from violating the statute in the first place.
Okay,
just a quick follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess the other issue that I would have is a private right of action is going to take a pretty specific action and a certain level of sophistication. I'm just not sure that's practical.
As a practical matter, well, what I see in many of these cases is a demand letter being sent from a lawyer to an employer, and it stops. It'll be very simple.
Okay.
That's good.
Okay, other questions? Representative Widener?
Madam Chair, I guess I'm having a little trouble because you said the agricultural industry and stuff, and I checked on blueberries just to see what they pay an hour, roughly about what a worker makes, and it's $20 to $28. They get $4 to $6 a bucket. That aside, what would stop somebody from basically just filing a suit saying they're not getting paid enough, and then now employers have to start defending this? That can drive cost up, and one of the other problems in the ag industry isn't so much with the person who's harvesting the crop or the farmer himself, is they'll contract with somebody who brings in these workers for the work. So they might be getting paid that $28 an hour. Doesn't mean he's given that to each worker that's out there. So there's probably a bigger problem with some of these contractors, and there's still guys out there that do this type of work, and that's probably who Boley should be focusing on rather than the farmers.
Okay, if one of you could answer, please.
Representative Daugherty, Chair Daugherty, Representative Widener. A couple things about that. The first one is, actually, most people in low-wage situations can't find a lawyer, so it's not going to be there that there's going to be a huge march to the courts. We did attempt in the Dash 1 amendments to build in some protections for employers so that in situations where the employer isn't necessarily involved in getting somebody a break, like if you're a receptionist at the front desk and it has to be covered, or if you're on a line and you have to be relieved, outside of those situations, we did provide some protections so that employers could be shielded from the kind of, I don't know, vengeance lawsuit or that sort of thing.
Okay, fine. Any other questions? Quickly, Representative Thatcher.
Yes, thank you. We just heard a Boley say that there's a whistleblower law. Doesn't that allow for private right of action right there?
Chair Dora, Representative Thatcher, it does provide for private right of action, but if the threat of firing, basically to exercise that private right of action, what Maria would have had to do is say, okay, fire me, I'm going to take my break. Then she loses her job, then she has a private right of action. But she has no damages that she can show for the threat that she might be fired if, in fact, she just gets back in line and complies. And because jobs are scarce and people need work, it's very unlikely that someone would do that.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Those are the last we had signed up. Anyone else on House Bill 3307? Okay, seeing none, I close the public hearing on House Bill 3307 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 3470. Jan, if you could summarize.
Madam Chair, committee members.
From your stack.
Mm-hmm. This bill allows a brewery public house, brew pub, or a winery licensee to operate a mobile premise for the purpose of dispensing securely covered containers of alcoholic beverages from the parked premises. So that would be a growler. There are no amendments. And
okay. Representative Widener.
Okay, Madam Chair.
We do have signed up Casey Fletch and Farshad Alahade. So go ahead, please.
Madam Chair Daugherty and distinguished members of the House Committee on Business and Labor, thank you for the time and consideration hearing House Bill 3470 today. My name is Rep.
Jim Widener, representing House District 24, with parts of both Yamhill and Washington County. House Bill 3470 is a very simple bill. The craft brew industry in Oregon is a $2.8 billion industry, according to the Oregon Brewers Guild. Oregon beer companies employ over 29,000 people, and their total tax contribution is over $485 million. We have 232 brewers or beer wholesalers in our state. Oregon hop farms grow over 17% of the hops used for brewing beer in the United States, according to the Oregon Hop Commission. What this bill is about, it's about jobs and advertisement. Breweries often find that with all responsibilities of life, their customers find it difficult to drive to their brick-and-mortar locations to purchase their products. That's why sales at restaurants and grocery stores far outweigh the actual brewery on-site sales. This bill is a companion bill to a successful growler legislation we passed earlier this session. I would like to take a brief moment to further explain what this bill does and does not do. Does this bill allow additional locations for alcohol consumption? No. Just as the growler bill passed only weeks ago, these mobile growler refill stations can only operate on premises where existing licensures for alcohol sales is already in operation. That means that only at a location where existing alcohol sales license are in use, for instance, a grocery store where beer is already being sold, a restaurant that already has an on-site alcohol license, could under this legislation allow for a mobile growler refill station to set up temporary locations on their property. The brewery and mobile unit will contract compensation privately with the on-site business and location. Why would a business want a mobile growler refill station in their parking lot? Well, for instance, let's say a brewery has a seasonal beer that is only in small batches and a restaurant has a contract with the brewery to sell their beer on tap. They might want to partner together to bring in customers who are seeking this exclusive small seasonal batch of brew and try to get a growler customer to come inside for lunch. Having owned a restaurant, you will see owners and managers go to extensive and creative lengths to attract customers to their location. I found that increased traffic was usually accompanied with increased revenue. I feel that the more exposure any business gets in that process, that is good for jobs and profits. Both breweries and restaurants utilize their contact database to inform customers about upcoming specials or discounts. And this is just an exciting new tool for these businesses to reach out to their customers. The mobile growler refill station must comply with the parameters defined by the licensure of the particular business. So this doesn't expand the location where alcohol can be purchased or change the hours of operation or scope of their existing alcohol sales licensure. This bill does expand employment opportunities upon passage. Breweries will now need to find qualified drivers and operators for their mobile growler refill stations. Businesses like restaurants and grocery stores are now looking at new avenues for business operation, and the state of Oregon will benefit from both the increased employment opportunities and revenue collected from the increased sales and profit. Colleagues, this is a very simple bill I know will deliver both quality Oregon craft brews and jobs across Oregon. With that, I will turn it over since we're on a short time and we have a lot more bills to work today.
Thank you, Mr. Barton and members of the committee. My name is Casey Flush. I live in Oregon City. I support House Bill 3470 because it creates another opportunity for entrepreneurs in one of Oregon's strongest industries to further promote the great craft beer that many Oregonians work every day to produce. The craft beer industry started in Oregon over 30 years ago by the same kind of original thinkers, experimenters, and home brewers that still power it today. The only difference is that it's come a long way since Kurt and Rob Widmer drove around to Portland bars offering samples of a new kind of beer that was cloudy and had a funny name. Today, the industry generates over $2.8 billion annually to the Oregon economy and keeps growing at a rate of 7% a year. Oregonians do love their craft beer. In recent years, growlers, which are the reusable glass vessels, have become a popular way for consumers to enjoy beer from their favorite breweries at home. Due to the high capital costs of packaging, as Representative Widener mentioned, growlers are a good way for small breweries to offer their beer outside their four walls, and they allow large breweries a way to distribute their seasonal and small batch offerings. Currently, many breweries throughout Oregon are licensed to fill growlers on-premise. In addition, a number of growler filling stations have opened that don't brew beer themselves, but instead fill growlers for consumers with beer from a variety of breweries. The city of Bend has been very open to these kind of businesses and has seen positive results over the past couple of years with a thriving new business sector and many new jobs created. House Bill 3470 would make a minor change to current law by allowing these mobile growler filling operations. The operations vehicle would be required to be parked on private property with the permission of the current public house licensee, and the OLCC would be able to inspect the vehicles as they do currently for fixed location operators. House Bill 3470 is a small change with big benefits. Oregon job creators can help promote one of Oregon's fastest growing industries by giving craft beer enthusiasts a convenient way to find beers made all over the state in their local community. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Flesh. I'd love to see more craft beer flowing in Oregon City, and God knows I do my part. Does anyone have any questions for this panel?
Representative Barton, you probably didn't want to put that on the record.
Any questions for this panel? Thank you for your testimony. Thanks for coming down. Come on up, please. One more on this bill.
Morning. Co-chairs, committee members, for the record, my name is Farshad Al-Adadi. I'm the Director of License Services at the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. The OLCC is neutral on House Bill 3470, but I do want to point out a couple concerns that we do have. And that really centers around the concept of a mobile premises. Under current law, licensed premises must be a fixed location on the ground. And I think there's some practical reasons for that we might all understand, but I'll just share some with you. If we know where the licensed sale and service of alcohol is going to occur, we have a better chance of monitoring compliance at those locations. What House Bill 3470 is proposing is allowing the sale of to-go sales of malt beverages and wine at locations where we may not be aware that that is occurring. And that presents possibly a concern from a public safety standpoint and from a community livability standpoint. I think that the OLCC is a very strong supporter of both the craft brewing and craft wine industry in Oregon, and we would support anything we can do to accommodate the growth in that marketplace. This seems like a simple fix, but I think that there might be some implications that we need to consider, and we're happy to work with the representative and the industry to find those solutions. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just, I understand your concerns and stuff on it, because the whole principle behind this is for it to be temporary, you know, like an event's going on in a community. They show up, have the growler refill station right there for that event on a licensed premise. If there was notification for the OLCC that this was going to happen and it's temporary, like if we put a time span, it couldn't be more than 1 week at any one location?
Chair Doherty, Representative Widener, we have this tool right now, and I hope we can get into the technical weeds here just for a brief moment. We have special event brew pub licenses and special event winery licenses where these brick and mortar small businesses can go to other locations on a temporary basis after notifying us and getting approval to sell on-premises consumption at those locations. A change might be to allow for off-premises sales at a special event license. Right now, that's prohibited. So that might be a solution under the current framework that would get you what you need, but might address also our issues about mobile premises.
Okay.
So we have those tools today. It's just what you can do with those special event licenses. Those licensees are prohibited from selling to-go in a growler.
Let me follow up.
Follow up, then I've got questions.
Yeah.
Because it has a schedule and everything in there. Have you been through the bill?
Yes,
thoroughly?
I have right here.
So, because it kind of takes a lot of that into consideration where they'd have a schedule for you and you would know pretty much where they're going. So you said you're neutral but had concerns. What is your biggest concern?
The biggest concern is that we're creating, Chair Doherty, Representative Widener, we're creating kind of a shadow licensing system. We have current licensing system for special event brew pubs and special event winery licenses, and what we're creating is an adjunct to that where it might be difficult if these mobile premises are going to another licensed premises. From a compliance standpoint, how do we assess responsibility should there be a violation? Is it the truck that's coming in that's not licensed, or is it the licensed establishment that has that, we have that administrative holdover? When something goes wrong, who do we hold responsible? That's our concern. That's why when we have we've worked through those issues in our current licensing practice, and if we could adhere to that practice, modify it, but the responsibility issues would be addressed directly in the current practice.
Go ahead, and then I have a question. We need to move on. We've got another 4 minutes for this.
Because I kind of see it being the licensed establishment, because they're the one hiring the mobile growler to come there, working out the arrangement with them. But let me think about that and talk with people.
So my question, I guess, use an example. Okay, we've got the Tigard Balloon Festival. Not that I'm pumping the Tigard Balloon Festival, but it usually is about the third weekend in June at Cook Park in Tigard. And so they have... It's very fun. 3 days. And so they go through and they have, for example, they'll have a beer garden.
Yes.
And so would this be, and so they do that and you sell a beer and you drink it there.
Yes.
And so with the mobile growler, and I'm sorry I had to leave for a few minutes, the truck would go and I could get a growler and then take it home with me from that?
That's the type
of... Is that one of the concerns?
Chair Doherty, that currently is prohibited, but if the law changes to allow that, then that would be fine.
Okay.
What I'm suggesting is that the concern is that we have an unlicensed vehicle. We might have some approval of that vehicle, but where and when and for how long those sales take place, it's not exactly clear that we have what we need in this bill, so that we could potentially have a vehicle moving from location to location selling, and the OLCC might not have an understanding of where those sales are taking place, and therefore may not be able to monitor compliance. At the special event alluded to, there are many different licensees that can locate on a temporary basis at these events today. Right now, they're limited to on-premises consumption. So a change might be for us to modify our special event license statutes to allow for off-premises sales. The businesses that might employ a mobile vehicle are already allowed to apply for these special event licenses. Okay. And it might be a cleaner way of handling it.
Yeah. Such as the Tigard Festival balloons the third week of June. Okay. Representative Holvey?
So you mentioned special event licenses for brew pubs and wineries. Do we also have special event licenses for breweries?
We currently do not.
And why not?
Currently, breweries are considered manufacturers, and we have a separation between the manufacturing, distribution, and retail tiers. A special event license would kind of blend those production market tiers, and current Oregon law, liquor laws, are set up to keep separation between them.
Okay. Another question, Chrissy?
Why?
Oh.
Wife, Representative Doherty, Chair Doherty, Representative Holvey. We have a three-tiered system in Oregon. Really, out of how the state chose to regulate alcohol sales after prohibition ended, and one of the principles is to maintain separation between those three. We do have some exceptions. Wineries and brew pubs are exceptions. That I'll note that. They have activities that are in each of those tiers, but they are the exception currently.
Thank you, Representative Kinnamer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment, I guess.
You know, you were talking about you would have no way of notice, but I think the reality is the bill requires that this be done under the auspice of an already licensed facility. So it would be on the property of a local bar or restaurant or whatever. And I guess I would go back to a recent bill that we had in this committee where we said that tax preparation could be done by the employees of an attorney. The responsibility was with the attorney. The responsibility here for the conduct in the sale of this product on their premises is the responsibility of the bar, restaurant, or whomever who has already an existing license. So I find your argument a little weak.
If I may, Chair Doherty, Representative Kinnamer, we have lots of marketing activity that take place on a licensed premises today. We have tastings that are sponsored by manufacturers, tastings that are sponsored by other businesses that in Oregon that are in the beer and wine and distilled spirits industry. These are tastings. And so under current law, Oregon Liquor Control Commission is responsible for regulating the sale and service. And when we're talking about selling growlers to go, that is a licensable activity. And it's not under, today, it's not under the auspices of the current license. If you have a third party coming in to make a sale, that is a licensable activity. And so who do we assess the responsibility for should there be a violation? Could be problematic for the host licensee, and it would be difficult for the agency to make that case.
Madam Chair?
Any other question? And we're going to, I'm going to stop this at five after, so go.
It's the current licensee who is responsible. So I have a restaurant, I have an OLCC license, I have the brew pub come and set up because I'm using it to market to get them to come to my facility and eat and make money probably off of them promoting their brew. I am the one responsible. And that's what it says. That's all it's doing. It's not changing anything else. Rather than having to come in and set up because I'm limited on space, they're just setting up right there in my parking lot for doing it. So, I mean, it's pretty clear, and it's the licensee who is responsible.
Chair Doherty, Representative Widener, is it the licensee, the host licensee's employees are selling the beverage? When you have another licensed establishment's employees coming to a host, it becomes unclear who is responsible. You have a licensed business that's manufacturing the beer and making the sale at a third location. Who's ultimately responsible for that is...
So if I brought their keg, brought it into my establishment,
I'm going to ask you guys to take this conversation offline. Thank you very much. Okay, any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. Okay, there's no one else signed up, so I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3470. And this is what we'll be doing for the rest of the hour. We have quite a few bills that the fiscals are not in yet. And so, Jan, I might need your help. Mm-hmm. So on House Bill 2672, which is the domestic worker, we don't have the fiscal on that. So we'll need to carry that one over. House Bill 2669, extending employee protections to student interns. Also, we're waiting for a fiscal on that one.
So carrying it over.
And we're carrying it over. House Bill 3076, which deals with, we're still waiting for a fiscal on that one.
That's correct.
On the post-employment disputes, we're holding that one. We need a fiscal. That was ready. Mm-hmm. House Bill 3473, with the one that we heard yesterday on Buy America, is we're also waiting. Actually, there's a bunch of amendments that are being worked on that one, so we want to wait till the amendments come through. We're probably not going to hear House Bill 3259, which is a good neighbor agreement.
3256.
Excuse me, 3256 or 3180, which is the off-premise license sales that we heard the other day. And we're still waiting for that one. We're still waiting for fiscals on 2977, so no, we'll just hold that one over. And
so we're carrying 20,
and that is it.
2977 over.
2977 we are carrying over.
Thank you.
No, we're going to be hearing those.
Okay, but, so the dash one, if we want to adopt it on...
When we get there, we're going to adopt the dash ones.
Yeah, so
we stand down just for a moment.
Broke the amendment.
Now we're standing up. And House Bill 3436, the Oregon Retirement Investment Board, we're waiting for fiscal, and we need somebody else to talk about the dash one amendment, so we're holding that one over also. And we are holding over House Bill 3142, definitions, because we're waiting for fiscal on that.
Carry these over that we heard today.
And just to be on the safe side, we'll carry over the two bills we heard today, 3470 and 3507. Doesn't necessarily mean they're going to be coming out. So, clear to everybody? Okay, so I'm going to start opening some work sessions, and the first work session is on House Bill 2524. And there are a couple of dash four and a dash five amendments. So, Jan, if you could summarize this. We talked about it on Wednesday.
Madam Chair and committee members, the measure limits the exemption, the construction contractor licensing requirements for financial institutions, real estate personnel, and the suppliers of workers. The dash four amendment, it exempts persons from the licensure requirements when they're working on one project or structure when the aggregate price of the contract is less than $1,000. Currently, that limit is $500. It also extends the licensure exemption to subsidiaries of those commercial lending institutions. The Dash 5 amendment exempts from licensure a real estate licensee who engages in the management of rental real estate. And it deletes the proposed restriction on exempting those that arrange for licensed contractors to perform work. There's no revenue impact on either of those amendments, and there's no fiscal impact on either of those amendments.
Okay. So, why don't we need to do amendments on both, and then we'll open it up for discussion.
As to which one you want to move.
Four and five are not oppositional, right? So we have to move both.
Move both. You can move both,
but represent will be.
Okay.
They're going to be, just committee members, there are going to be two amendments adopted. First, Chair Doherty, I move to adopt the dash four amendments to House Bill 2524.
Okay. Representative Barton moves to adopt the dash four amendments to House Bill 2524. Is there any discussion? Okay, is there any objection? Okay, seeing none, the dash four amendments are adopted.
Chair Doherty, I move to adopt the dash five amendments to House Bill 2524.
Okay, Representative Barton moves the adoption of the dash five amendments to House Bill 2524. Is there any discussion? Representative Barton.
Thank you, Chair Doherty. I just wanted to commend industry. I feel like they engaged with Representative Holvey. I think the dialogue was more constructive than it often is in this building. I wanted to acknowledge that and thank them.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Okay. Any other discussion? Is there any objection? Okay. Seeing none, the dash five amendments are approved or adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2524 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Okay. Representative Barton moves House Bill 2524 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just I want to commend my good colleague, Representative Holvey. He had a concept coming forward and had some opposition out there, was working with the industry and found some common ground. I don't believe this is the bill that he really wanted, but he's able to compromise to get something towards what he's trying to get, and I support him on it. And I just appreciate that type of work that goes into compromise, trying to find some middle ground that moves us forward.
It is. That's how we get legislation passed. So anyway, thank you very much.
Bittersweet.
Okay, I just want to clarify that this was actually, this was a compromise, both of these amendments were a compromise with both banks and realtors. It seems like they were the ones that had the most heartburn with the original language, or?
Madam Chair, I can probably speak to that, though I hesitate to speak for the industry.
If they'd like to come up.
But the bankers wanted the Dash 4 amendments, and the realtors wanted the Dash 5 amendments, and I wanted the Dash 7 amendments, and they won.
And you didn't get it. Is there anyone from the industry that would like to speak? Okay, fine, thank you. Does that answer your question?
I like that compromise.
I like that compromise. They got it and I didn't. Okay. That's what we call compromise. So we call compromise in a marriage. Okay, is there any further discussion? Is there any further discussion? Okay, seeing none. Brandon, could you call the roll, please?
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Representative Thompson.
Aye.
Representative Fagan.
Aye.
Representative Widener.
No.
Representative Thatcher.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Vice Chair Representative Kennemer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Representative Barton.
Aye.
Chair Representative Doherty.
Aye. Okay, motion passes. And Representative Holvey, would you like to carry the bill, please?
He lost.
I'll carry it if you prefer not to.
Would you like Representative Barton to carry it?
I'll carry it.
Okay. Representative Holvey will carry it on the floor. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2524. And this was not enough. Okay, House Bill 2669, we had already said, is going to be carried over. We will not be hearing House Bill 2908. And carrying over House Bill 3076. Are we carrying that one over too?
It's ready. It's in the
Okay, we're going to carry over House Bill 3342. Carry over 3473. It's got kind of a pattern here. Oh, we can talk about this one. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2706.
Okay.
And Jan, if you could summarize it.
02?
How about 2702? I
Let's
open
do
a work
that
session
okay.
on 2702.
Madam Chair and committee members, this measure establishes a process for the OLCC to adopt rules declaring an alcohol impact area upon the petition of a municipality. It establishes a process for granting an exemption and for the review of a rule. It declares an emergency effective on passage. The proposed Dash 5 amendment allows for any municipality to file a petition for an alcohol impact area. It limits the sale of certain alcoholic beverages within the alcoholic impact area using a list of products. Requires OLCC to respond to requests from municipalities to alter that product list within 30 days. Requires the municipality to report back to the legislature as to the effects of this alcohol impact area 2 years after it's fully implemented. And we do not have the fiscal on that Dash 5 amendment, but if the committee wished, they could adopt the amendment today.
Okay. Thank you very much for the summary. Is there anyone who would like to talk about the Dash 5s? Are you ready? Available to do that?
I have a question.
Yeah, if you can go through and talk about the Dash 5s, because they say we're waiting on the fiscal on this, but there was a lot of work on this bill going back and forth to try to deal with the issues.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I saw someone else in the audience, too, who expressed an interest.
Okay. Anyone want to talk about the Dash 5s? We're here.
Come on.
They won't shoot you.
This will be a good test how people get along.
I know. You have security there. You're good.
I'm sort of a model.
You're controlled there. Is what it is.
It's okay. Chair Doherty, members of the committee. For the record, Andy Smith for the City of Portland. Thanks for the work session and the opportunity to go through the Dash 5 amendments. I'll try and go through them quickly. Starting with Section 2, it applies to cities and counties. Section 3 applies before a petition can be accepted by the commission. It requires, it gives OLCC express statutory authority, clarifying the authority that we already think they have. It requires a petitioning jurisdiction to file a petition, and before they do, they have to give an opportunity for public comment. They have to allow businesses to explain why they should be exempt. It requires a petition to the OLCC to include proposed geographic boundaries, documentation of chronic problems, proposed uniform requirements, an explanation of why those proposed requirements are going to alleviate the chronic problems in the area. Like I said, opportunity for public comment has to be described in the petition as well, and documentation that the products proposed to be controlled are linked to the chronic problems in the proposed geographic area. Section 4 applies after the petition's been accepted. It requires identification of each product for which sale is controlled. The first point in Section 4 is for products that are substitutes for products that are already on a list after it's implemented. So if a new product comes into the market that is essentially the same thing, so let's say Steel Reserve 212 becomes Steel Reserve 211, this is the first piece of Section 4 addresses how you get that product on the list as well. And a local jurisdiction would have to ask the OLCC in writing to add that product to the list and show that it's materially similar to a product that's already on the list, and link that to the chronic problems in the area. It gives OLCC 30 days to process this request. It's an expedited approval process, which is a little bit of a safeguard for the local jurisdiction. We're flexible with that number. It was just a number we put out there. If that's too burdensome on the agency, we're happy to work with them to find the right number. The other piece of Section 4 is for after a list has already been created there's a different product that becomes a problem. And it also requires that we ask in writing for that specific product to be added to the list. The written request must prove that that product is linked to the chronic problems in the area. And it gives OLCC, again, 30 days. Again, we're flexible on that time frame. Now, that Section 4 that I just described is what I would consider a true productless approach. It's the language from the Dash 1 amendments. If it's not a true productless approach, I'm happy to find a way to get there. I haven't been told what changes to, and we've only had this amendment for less than a day, so appreciate the short time frame there. But if there's a way to get to a true productless approach that's amenable to industry, we're willing to do it. But I don't know outside of their own language in the Dash 1s what they need to do to get there. Section 5 is...
But you're willing to work on that.
Absolutely, okay. Absolutely. Section 5 is after implementation of an alcohol impact area. It allows a licensee that's inside of a controlled area to request an exemption from the requirements of the area. In their request, they have to explain why they're not contributing to the problem. Section 6 allows the OLCC can require a city to keep them informed on the progress of implementation and how the area is working. It also requires a city 2 years after implementation to come back to you all and let you all know how it's going. And I think that's an important safeguard for businesses and affected in the affected area to know that there's going to be another look 2 years after implementation, and everybody's going to have a chance to hear how it's going and how it's working. And I'm sure we'll be bringing the data that we've collected to show you, and I think you'll have a good basis for knowing whether you want to change anything or not. Section 7 permits anyone to petition the OLCC for review of an alcohol impact area at any time. And in their petition, they have to explain why review is warranted. And if the petition is accepted, it allows OLCC to alter, amend, or repeal the rule according to the petitioning process and rulemaking. Section 9, I'm actually not sure what that means. I read it as some kind of a grandfather clause. It seems to say that if an alcohol impact area is implemented prior to the effective date of this bill, that it's grandfathered in. Yeah. But there's no alcohol impact areas that have been implemented, so it doesn't apply to anything. I don't know what it wasn't something that we asked to be in there. And if there's a reason for it, maybe a legislative council could clear that up. But it doesn't seem to be necessary. If it is, perhaps somebody else could tell us why.
Maybe there's some alcohol impact area that we've have absolutely no idea where it is.
No harm in it, anyway.
Or welcome to our world while LC screws up your bills for you.
Oh.
Well, I just say that.
He said that, not me.
I just say that.
Widener.
I don't think it does any harm, but I also don't see if there's no areas that have been implemented right now, I don't see the purpose as far as I can tell.
Okay. Thank you. Anybody else like to comment on the dash, the large dash, whatever these are, fives?
Yes. Thank you, Chair Doherty. Members of the committee, for the record, Hasina Squires here today on behalf of the Wine Institute, which represents California wineries. We are opposed to the Dash 5 amendments. Also, the Beer and Wine Distributors Association is opposed. Whole Foods is opposed. The Neighborhood Association stores are opposed. Those are the entities that contacted us in advance of this hearing, having just received these amendments yesterday afternoon. First of all, I'd just like to say that these amendments would ban a legal product. We don't agree with that, and I'd just like to indicate that chronic public inebriates are going to drink no matter what. So drawing a boundary and telling them that they can't access alcohol is only going to shift the problem elsewhere. It may somewhat disperse it in little pockets and not in giant areas. But specifically as it relates to the city of Portland, we don't believe that this will solve the problem because there's a liquor store located within the proposed boundaries of the city of Portland's alcohol impact area. And if you can't access high alcohol content beer or wine in large quantities, you're more likely to switch to a hard liquor product, which is actually available and will be readily sold within the boundaries of the alcohol impact area in Portland. The Dash 5 amendment is not a product-specific approach. If you take a look on page 2, section 3, sub 3, it says, if a petition includes a request to limit, if it so chooses to limit.
Sorry, where?
Page 2, section 3, sub 3, which is line 16. If a petition includes a request to limit or prohibit the effect, the off-premise sales of specific alcohol. It says if. It doesn't say it is required. Nothing would keep a city under these amendments from including a broad ban in their petition. And in fact, Portland did come forward with a broad ban in their petition initially for 2 years. So the wording really doesn't make it product specific as the only way to ban alcohol. It leaves discretion to other areas. The same issue is repeated on page 3 in section 4, sub 1, including but not limited to. So we're really back to the same issue of the ability to ban broad categories of wine. Portland proposed to ban any wine over 14% alcohol content, all box wine, and any wine over 2 liters in over 2 liter container packages. Of that, 55 of the 720 incidents accounted for 7.6% of the problem was wine, yet the city of Portland still pursued their proposed ban on large categories of wine. So we're very concerned that any language that you adopt not provide the ability to enact broad bans, and this language would. Other problems with the Dash 5 amendment is that the entire city could be drawn as an AIA. Nothing in this amendment prevents a city from enacting an entire city as an alcohol impact area. It has no limitation on boundaries. The amendment does not limit the type of wine that could be banned to fortified wine, and that is the only type of wine that we believe should be banned as a legal product if it is linked to a serious problem. It also doesn't require the city itself to study the effectiveness of an alcohol impact area and provide an annual report to OLCC. There is no assessment on OLCC's part about whether or not the AIA is working. They are the regulatory agency for alcohol in the state. We think that's appropriate. There is no mechanism contained in the bill to notify distributors and retailers about what products are banned. There's just silent on that subject. And furthermore, it allows more than one alcohol impact area in a city. And it allows every single city in the state of Oregon to adopt an alcohol impact area, and we do not support that. It also doesn't allow OLCC to terminate an alcohol impact area if they find that it's not working. And then Section 9, as Mr. Smith said, he wasn't sure what it did. From our reading, it appears to grandfather a petition that City of Portland had that really wasn't actually accepted, so we don't understand why that would be in there, because their petition actually didn't really move forward in the rulemaking process all the way.
Okay, thank you. Did you want to add anything, sir?
So, good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Hogan. I'm a sergeant with the Portland Police Bureau's Drugs and Vice Division. I'm here mostly this morning to help answer any questions that the committee may have in terms of practical nature, how we may implement this. I do want to say Just one comment that opposition made with respect to the results of an alcohol impact hearing. Again, in our original testimony several weeks ago, the only example that we have of a local alcohol impact area is up in Seattle and Tacoma area. So with respect to that, I can tell you that having gone up there to visit them, they also have state-run liquor stores within their alcohol impact area. And they showed proven results with reducing the number of trips to their detox station with chronic inebriants, and also reducing their citations for alcohol in the park and public drinking within their alcohol impact area, despite the fact that they had state-run liquor stores, and they also didn't see a widespread dispersal of the problem. So, just in terms of the little bit of historical data that we do have, I can tell you from my own personal experience, having talked to them, that the issues that opposition raised, I understand how they can create concern, but from what we've seen with the local examples, I think it's overstated.
Okay, thank you. We're going to have about 5 minutes for questions. Are there any questions of the panelists? Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. A question about the language used. You may or may not know it. Perhaps you can, I don't think we're moving it today, but perhaps you can get with LC. But it seems to me that if there's one phrase in here that might be controversial or ambiguous, it's the substantial and material similarities. What does substantial and material mean? Is that a term of art, or are you taking that from somewhere else? Is there
You know, that whole section, Chair Doherty, Representative Barton, that whole section, what I asked for in the Dash 5s was essentially to adopt the language of the Dash 1s, which were the California Wine Institute's amendments, in an effort to get to where we needed to be on a true product list approach. Now, I think that language is in there to say, if a substitute product comes onto the market that is the same for all intents and purposes as a product that's already on the list, it's substantial and material, we have to ask in writing for that product to go on the list, and we have to show that, we have to explain that it's substantial and material and it's linked to the problems in our written request. So, it's their language trying to get there with them, and I think it's an important piece because there are substitute products in other markets that can be redirected into a market that may have an alcohol impact area within it. I know that Kevin's talked to the folks in Washington, and they saw that happen. It's allowing us to ask OLCC to include products when there's a new product and also when additional products become problems. And that's why there's two pieces there.
Chair Doherty, Representative Barton, that language comes from the modeled after the Washington provisions. And it does not mean that if you have, let's say, I don't know, brand X, high alcohol malt beverage, sorry, Donnell, or whatever, Mad Dog 2020 fortified wine, you have that. My client makes that. You had that, and that product was banned, and there was a substantially similar product. That does not mean that it automatically goes on the list. Substantially similar means Mad Dog 2020 in a small container, and then they just increase. It's a 12-ounce container, and it goes to a 10-ounce container. It goes to a 12-ounce container. Substantially, it's extremely difficult to take the exact same product and relabel it and get it out the door. It just doesn't happen. It did not happen in Washington. What happened in Washington initially when the alcohol impact areas were adopted was that people would just change the size and the packaging and keep the same product in it and just send it out as, oh, well, you didn't ban 10-ounce, so we'll put it in a 12-ounce. And that's been remedied in the language that says substantially similar and then a packaging requirement, so we're all banned.
Okay. Other questions? Are you satisfied, Jim?
Yes,
thank
you.
Representative Witt?
Madam Chair, I'd like to make a comment if I could. I'm getting extremely tired of successive amendments where we are told that this is going to be a product-specific list. It appears that it's not. And I recognize that Ms. Squires may have an interest in not addressing a language that would hurt her clients, but she seems to be the only one that I have heard from that understands what a product-specific list is, and before we do another amendment, if she would be willing to at least review the language, it might save us from having to do another amendment. One more, Madam Chair, and I swear I'm a no on the vote on the bill, period. I'm that upset with it.
We are being amended to death lately, but thank you. Mr. Witt, Mr. Thompson, please.
I have a two-part question. If we accept that the alcohol impact areas work to reduce what the problem, what is the evidence that the problem doesn't move to another block? And I ask that because I'm suspicious that, like a lot of things we deal with here, this isn't a problem with alcohol. It's a problem with problem people, and they tend to be fairly mobile. Is there any evidence that an alcohol impact area doesn't just impact the next area, which would get us to the citywide eventually?
Chair Doherty, Representative Thompson, I'm sure that Kevin could add a couple sentences to this, but I think, first of all, you heard from the chief of police from Eugene at the public hearing. He cited that although there may be some disbursement, overall, the crime numbers come down, whether it's through their voluntary alcohol impact area or whether it's through specific enforcement on any criminal activity in a concentrated area. Numbers come down across the board, and the chief testified to that. And as far as expanding the areas across the city, I mean, that's so highly unlikely because you have to document the problems in the area that you're proposing to regulate and connect them. So, I mean, it'd be impossible because it doesn't exist across Portland or any city where you have chronic alcohol problems across the entire city. It would just never get that big.
Chair Doherty, Representative Thompson. In Washington, what we have found is, yes, there is disbursement. You will break up the chronic public inebriates. You'll move them around. They'll go. They are extremely mobile, and they need their alcohol, and they're going to get it. So they'll walk for it. They'll go across the Burnside Bridge to Plaid Pantry. Our experience in Washington has been that initially there's some initial disbursement, and people move around, and then more alcohol impact areas are created because they move other places.
Okay. Tom's follow-up and then Representative Matthews.
I'd just like to see some data on that because, to me, it seems like we're dealing with a situation where we need to know what happens to the people with the alcohol problem. And even the word disbursement is a nice word, but it's the same number of people. We just put them over a larger area so we don't see them. As obviously, it doesn't address the problem of vagrancy, homelessness, and alcoholism. And I'm just not quite there yet that this is a solution that's going to happen. I mean, why don't we do a food impact area and we'll take Twinkies away from an area that has a large number of fat people? That should solve the fat problem.
Representative Thompson, we did take away Twinkies.
Unfortunately, I was a ho-ho man in Los Angeles.
We're going to do it in public buildings now, Representative.
I just have this overwhelming feeling that this will make everybody feel really good in the impacted area as they watch the impact go somewhere else. I think we tried this in a number of communities with prostitution, with police clampdowns on an area of high density. And guess what? We did not reform any prostitutes. They moved someplace else. And I don't see the treatment part.
Chair Doherty, Representative Thompson, we've never pretended that this is going to solve all alcohol problems in our community. What we understand it to be and what has been proven in Washington and on a voluntary basis in Eugene is that when you limit the high alcohol content, low-priced liquor, people and to people who can't access it, they can't get the alcohol for their buck, they don't get as drunk, and they don't cause as many problems. And it's a way to tone down criminal behavior, public safety hazards, neighborhood livability issues in areas where it's very concentrated and has profound effects and where it affects other businesses. And that's why Clean and Safe Downtown, which is a contingent of the Portland Business Alliance with many, many business members, retailers, you name it, supports this bill because it's a tool to make areas of the city which currently aren't friendly again so people can come back and frequent their businesses.
Okay, thank you. Did you have a question, Ms. Matthews?
I do. So, Madam Chair, I've been struggling with this, and you know, Sergeant Hogan, I appreciate you being here, and thank you for your service and all that you're doing. I know you'd rather be on patrol than here, and I appreciate that very much.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think Russ Roach is easier?
Trust me, I know for the record, he is a firefighter.
And not wearing turnouts despite the heat in the building sometimes. But I guess my point is on this, I'm treading lightly because I don't believe the burden of proof is that steep of a hill to climb. I really think you could associate a couple of key business folks, a couple of neighborhood folks, a couple of police officers, and go before a group and say, this is a problem, this is what we need to do, and you'll get approval. I don't think that's going to be that steep to do, and that's why I'm concerned about the sprawl. But in these new Dash 5s, which we can go back and I think Representative Witt covered some of that, we talked yesterday, and the 30 days, and I appreciate your testimony today saying that's a number that's kind of arbitrary, we could look to something else. But in terms of expediting the approval of the agency, if they don't get back in 30 days, you're able to put this market, the way this is written, you're able to put that product on your list and just move forward as if you got approval. Is that correct?
Chair Doherty, Representative Matthews, that's the way it's written, and again, it's a safeguard because we want to make sure that when we're asking for a product to be on the list that it's actually acknowledged and looked at. I mean, like I said, the 30 days is just what we came up with. We haven't had a lot of you know, other folks suggesting language that is better, but if it needs to be 60 days, if it needs to be 50 days, I mean, we're willing to consider it, but the idea is that it needs to be a reasonable time frame for the agency to process the request and respond, because we know other products exist or labels change or whatever it is, and those products should be able to be addressed by the local government on some kind of a reasonable time basis.
And just follow up to that, thank you, Madam Chair. So the agency said that 30 days is reasonable because they have yet to submit a fiscal yet. So you heard that 30 days is reasonable?
Chair Doherty, Representative Matthews, I put that in the bill without checking with the agency. I did check with them subsequently. They said perhaps you know, a higher number would be better. And like I said, I'm happy to accommodate. It was just in trying to get these amendments done quickly and trying to respond to industry concerns quickly. You know, sometimes you don't have a chance to sort of run the gamut of stakeholders, but I'm certainly willing to work with anybody to find reasonable ground. That's why we've had so many iterations of this bill, because of an effort to get there with people who had concerns, address the concerns of wine folks who don't want their products included. We don't want them included either if they're not part of the problem. We even went so far as to adopt their own language to get there. And you know, so if that doesn't do it, I'd be happy to entertain any ideas of what does, including raising that 30-day requirement.
Chair Doherty, thank Representative you. Matthews, I'd just like to point out for the committee.
And if you could summarize quickly, because yep, I'm going to shut you off in a minute and a half.
You bet. Jennifer, March 5th, we proposed a Dash 1 amendment that we would support, and we will stick by that. You had a hearing. 5 days later, we provided you with a Dash 1 amendment that we would support, and the language is clearly in there.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. And if any of you have questions offline, other than the sergeant, I think the other guys are in the building, so you can ask the questions. Okay, I close the public hearing, or close the work session on House Bill 2702. And actually, I'm going to open, when we are ready to move, open a work session on House Bill 3435.
2 years.
Jan, if you could summarize the bill, please.
Madam Chair, committee members, the bill increases the number of locations a distillery licensee may hold a full-on premises sales license for the alcoholic beverages from 1 to 4. The proposed amendment replaces the measure. It increases from 1 to 5 the number of premises in addition to that distiller's premise where the distiller can conduct tastings. There's a minimal revenue impact and there is a minimal fiscal impact.
Chair Doherty, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3435.
Okay, Representative Barton moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3435. Is there any discussion? Okay, is there any objection? Okay, seeing none, the Dash 1 amendments are adopted.
Chair Doherty, I move House Bill 3435 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Okay, Representative Barton moves the House Bill 3435 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. as amended recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay. Seeing none, Brandon, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Widener.
Aye.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Representative Fagan.
Aye.
Representative Thatcher.
Aye.
Representative Thompson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Representative Barton.
Aye.
Vice Chair Representative Kennemer.
Aye.
Chair Representative Doherty.
Aye. Okay, the motion passes. And this was brought to us by Representative Gomberg, so I'm going to ask him to carry it on the floor. Okay, I close the work session on House Bill 3435 and open a work session on House Bill 2977. Jan, if you could summarize.
Madam Chair, members. Committee heard this bill March 13th. It requires that construction labor contractors be licensed with BOLI. Establishes the licensing requirements, the fees, and the exceptions. Directs BOLI to administer and enforce these requirements and to adopt rules. Establishes the grounds for denying, suspending, or revoking that license. Specifies the duties of the construction labor contractors. Authorizes BOLI to assess civil penalties. Prohibits certain actions and discrimination against employees. Creates a cause of action against persons acting as a construction labor contractor without a license. Declares an emergency effective on passage. There's a proposed dash one amendment that specifies that nothing in the farm labor contractor statutes affects whether the person is an employee of a construction labor contractor for the purposes of wage claims, for the minimum wage law, employment conditions, and for farm labor contractor statute 658415. There is no revenue impact, and we are waiting on the fiscal, but the committee could adopt the dash one amendment.
Okay. Do you want to adopt the dash one? That's Chair Doherty, I move to adopt the dash one amendments to House Bill 2977.
Okay, Representative Barton moves to adopt the dash one amendments to House Bill 2977. Is there any discussion? Representative Kennemer.
I don't anticipate supporting the bill, but I don't object to the amendment.
Okay, thank you very much. Any further discussion? Okay, is there any objection? Duly noted. One. Okay. If not, the amendments are adopted. And this cannot move to the floor. We're still waiting for a fiscal?
That's correct.
Okay, so we've adopted the amendments. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2977. And actually, I do believe that's it. The next two, House Bill 3142 and House Bill 3436, need to be carried over. And we'll also just carry over House Bill 2702.
Actually, Madam Chair, you could probably work 3470.
That'd probably come out 34,
so I already mentioned that. I mentioned that earlier. And it's just a code go through it. It's not always a guarantee that they're going to go, but at least they'll have an opportunity.
I don't think there's anybody in here to object to it now, so it could be now.
No, they left.
Oh.
Okay.
But you got overruled earlier.
Okay, any other business? Representative Matthews.
Madam Chair, just a real quick comment. A comment was made earlier, and we were just joking, I know, but, you know, about LC. I really want to defend those folks down there. I'm telling you what, they are putting out amendments left and right for people trying to adjust their bills on a last-minute deal. There's hundreds of bills mm-hmm. being adjusted. There's about four people down there getting the work done. Over and over and over again, I really want to just say thank you to them and encourage folks, too. If you're amending a bill that's directing an agency to do something, work with the agency to get it done, because it is not fun to have amendment after amendment after amendment come in needing more amendments with the time crunch we're under now. And so just a quick thank you to LC, all the folks down there doing great work. And
also
thank
to
you.
Legislative Revenue Office, because apparently, I understand they've got about 600.
Madam Chair, is the one who made the comment. Yes, I have. Agree. LC is getting slammed with stuff, and I mean, people just go running in, and some of the stuff I put the blame on us, because we probably should tell them, you know what, this is probably not a direction we should be going this time until you come with something that's ready to go, and probably should cut some of this stuff
stuff off at the pass before it even gets this far.
And so. I think Representative Matthews also talked about going to the agencies because a lot of times that's where it's worked out. Representative Thompson.
The other part of that, too, is when we're going through the budgets, let's be cautious about not cutting the budget for legislative support functions and then coming back and complaining that we don't have anybody to get the work done.
Yes.
As we have done that numerous times, and we're just piling on more and more on fewer and fewer people, and at some point, I think we have to look at some other state budgets that have been growing at really big rates and say, we'd like to have a little of that back here. Mm-hmm. Because we're representing the people of Oregon, and we're understaffed to do that, while the agencies that we're trying to control, some of them are running amok.
Okay.
And let's not forget legislative fiscal, and yes. Certainly I agree, everybody, this state needs more revenue for its services.
Yeah.
Just a minute. We were on
that note, I will
offended a winner.
Reading for alcohol,
I will adjourn the
too.
House Committee on Business and Labor.
That's as bad as tigered balloons.
Third weekend.